Hello, and welcome to the first ever episode of Three Bean Salad. I am Mike, also in Three Bean Salad. The other beans are... Got to introduce yourself.
Benjamin Partridge.
Benjamin Partridge. Yeah.
And...
Henry Packer Bean.
And Henry Packer. And we will be discussing a thing.
I actually... This is just completely coincidental, this, but I did actually soak a packet of mixed beans last night.
Wow. And that's exactly the sort of thing we won't be talking about on this show.
Because it's not a bean-themed show anyway, but I say...
Well, we might.
I bought a packet...
I can't promise anything.
I tell you what, I bought a packet of beans in a supermarket, of dry beans, right? And it was a bean mix, so lots of different colours of beans. They look quite gorgeous at that point, quite attractive. They look a bit like jelly beans, but they're nature's beans, right? Right. I soaked them overnight because there's so much work you have to put into beans. But anyway, I did it. I soaked them overnight.
Oh, yeah.
This morning, I then had to boil them for an hour and a quarter. And at the end of all that, all you end up with is just like a bunch of beans. It's such a high-maintenance product for what it is, which is a load of beans. And also...
And that anecdote...
Well, no.
Quite innately illustrates the nature of this podcast is that we're going to be discussing all sorts of things, a topic.
Sorry, Mike, I didn't realise that, I knew it was called Three Bean Salad. I didn't realise that we were talking principally about beans.
No.
Well, this is where the introduction has already gone very wrong, although it did illustrate the point that there won't necessarily be any big payoffs, just as has been illustrated by Henry's bean anecdote. No.
Although, having said that, you may have judged me a bit too soon in terms of payoffs, because I haven't actually finished my bean anecdote.
to apologise.
One, because actually the anecdote itself is still happening in the sense that I've still got most of those beans in my fridge.
So this is very much a hot anecdote.
It's a hot anecdote. We're mid anecdote in a way. I don't know how it's going to end yet. And that's life, isn't it? So there'll be truth in the podcast as well like that. But one thing, they've lost all their lustrous colour through boiling. They've become a grey, just a kind of uniform grey, sludgy mush. They filled the house with a really horrible bean smell.
So they're the opposite of lobsters.
They're the opposite of lobsters.
Is what we've discovered about
a
beans.
Lobster starts gross. You boil it becomes a lovely orange lustrous snack food. Mm-hmm. Whereas when it starts out, it's a disgusting, like a kind of Satan, sort of like a hellish demon creature, slimy creature of the hellish deeps, isn't it? Gross.
That stinks of beans.
Tentacles, it's got slime, it's got eyes that go in different directions. It's a fucking absolute freak, isn't it?
It's just like a cooked bean.
What you're saying is...
It's very much the cooked bean of the sea.
It's often referred to as the cooked bean of the sea. Also, it likes to soak. It'll soak for even longer than beans. It'll soak for almost all of its childhood and adult life. Anyway, all I'm saying is beans, they're a lot of work. I'm yet to really feel that they're worth it.
Okay.
A cautionary tale there from Henry Packer.
Well, Mike, I think in a way that Henry's little ongoing hot anecdote there is a nice explainer really to the audience as to what the podcast is, in that I think we should tell them what the format is. They probably are none the wiser at this stage.
No, fair play.
So the idea is that we will, in each episode, discuss a different topic. This episode, we aren't discussing beans, but were we discussing beans, the sort of thing Henry just did would have been sort of in the wheelhouse.
But potentially would have been cut out.
Very much the same.
Might have been cut out.
Same, might have been cut out. But yeah, very much the same level of preparation, i.e. nothing. We are ambushed with a topic. We embrace that topic for one episode and then we are done.
But also, you decide, don't you, the listener? You tell us what's... The listener tells us what to talk about.
They will, although not for this episode because this is our first episode.
Not for the first six, actually, because we've already recorded some. And we've instead of getting prompts from you, the public, we've got prompts from a man called Gareth.
Yeah. So essentially, the audience gets to decide in the same way that Russia is a democracy. Yeah.
What?
getting pretty heavyweight early doors there, Henry.
Yeah, I thought it was actually a fair comparison. In that, it has the structures of a democracy, doesn't it? Nominally, does it? Russia?
Yeah, okay.
So again, but again, Henry, you are doing a great job actually of illustrating, because again, the levels of research, we might not necessarily know what we're talking about when we start talking about something. Yeah, well, welcome. And if we do have any listeners in Russia, get in touch.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? Listeners should feel free not only to bamboozle us with new topics, but also, you know...
Have you had a different experience of boiling beans?
this is your platform. Finally. At last. It's here. Okay, well, let's try this. This is Three Bean Salad with Henry Packer, Benjamin Partridge and Mike Wozniak. Every episode, we're going to talk about a thing.
That's right, and that thing will be... picked at random from a hat full of suggestions from the audience, but we don't yet have an audience, so it's currently just picked out of a hat of suggestions from a man called Gareth, late 30s from Neath, South Wales. Lovely guy.
Here we go.
So today's theme is posters.
Posters.
Who were your, who or what were your posters, your teenaged posters?
Oh, that's good. So I had, I got into comics at a point, and I had loads, the idea of it now is so embarrassing to me, but I had loads and loads of Batman posters that I thought were incredibly cool. And you know when you're a teenager... It's all about, like, I'm into this thing and other people who are into it might realise I'm into it too and think I'm good. So that's why you get into T-shirts so much, T-shirts with the band that I'm into on. And you really hope that one day somehow you'll connect with someone, essentially. You'll be on a train or...
You'll signal and to the right tribe.
It may even be a band you don't particularly ever listen to or like.
Yeah. May very well be that. And what you're hoping will happen is, across a crowded train, the most beautiful woman in the history of Earth will see the T-shirt band that you're into.
Oh, yeah.
And she will waft across the crowded commuter train and sweep you up in her arms and carry you away and live with you, even though you are 14 years old and she works in the city.
It's quite a maternal element to that fantasy.
It's
very revealing.
I may have revealed too much, but basically, no. You want connection, right? You want to signal what you're into. It's part of your identity, isn't it? And posters are really important when you're a teenager. It's like, I'm into this, but and also I'm going to publicly say that I'm into it, so that hopefully other people who are into it will make love to me.
Oh, there's a bit of curation going on, yeah, because you're imagining someone is going to come round at some point.
Yeah, you know. But the thing that was so pathetic about it was that for someone to notice my Batman posters, they'd have to befriend me and come into my room. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's the long game, isn't it?
It's such
a long game. Especially with a city professional.
Exactly, especially with 30s. A city professional. It's
very unlikely you're going to be able to groom someone two or three times your own age.
Exactly.
A Deutsche Bank executive that you're leading into your teenage
Deutsche
bedroom.
Deutsche Bank executive.
A multilingual French economist.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm doing my
A-levels. God. You also like Batman.
you know, Henry, you're only 17 years old. And I am an incredibly successful, physically extraordinary specimen of a German banking woman. Yeah? I live my life every day, meetings. Oh no, every day another man with a big heavy watch and multiple cars. Oh, I'm bored of them, Henry. It's you that I like, you with your folders, your A-levels hanging over you. And
your new pubes.
Your freshly minted pubes. And, you know, I like that you respect your family. You still go on holiday with them. I like that. Yeah, I like that you still have pets, small pets in the cage, in your room. I like this. A lot of the men I'm meeting, Henry, in Dusseldorf, you know, downtown in New York, I do a lot of international meetings. They're not like you, Henry. You know, that
they don't have a gerbil that they've named after their favorite wizard.
None of them. You know what, Henry? A lot of them don't even have a favorite wizard. Oh no! But that's what I did. On some level, I did think that was going to happen if I got enough of the right Batman posters up.
If your chance draw, well, you've got to be in it to win it, right?
That was the you one know? Time I really got into something enough to go, I want to live in a kind of igloo made of this stuff.
I think you're the only person I know whose teenage fantasy involves being on a commuter train as well.
You know, it's just the grind, isn't it, Henry? Every day I'm here on my way to an expensive meeting, you know, and every day I've got so much perfume on me and I've got so many little clinky metal things on my handbags. I've got so many handbags, the little clinky metal things that keep it together, you know, Henry? And I get so tired.
It's teenage levels of research as well, you know, yeah. The expensive meeting, because that's what they have in cities, they have expensive
Henry.
Meetings.
And Henry, your hands get so bored and hot and on the way into work, you know? And then I see you, Henry, there, sitting there, and I know that you've got to, like, Detective Comics, which is the best, when Norm Breyfogle was illustrating Batman. So this is issues 375 to around early 400s. Frank Miller did some of the writing.
Oh, and I see you've doodled it's your own so version good. Of the Joker in your little notebook. Is that your own doodle? Do you illustrate so beautifully, Henry?
I love the way you draw the Batman and all the villains. You know them all, Henry.
Oh, and look here, you've invented your own little car. Oh, it's your own special superhero car you've invented.
It's called Henry's Special Mega Car.
Oh, it can fly and go underwater and go invisible.
It can go to so many places, Henry, that I'm feeling very, very, very hot now. You know, that kind of thing. Is that, yeah.
As a teenager, I largely lusted after other teenagers, I think, rather than professional women.
I think, to be honest, the truth is I went to mainly boys' schools until girls didn't come in until quite late on in my schools. And I just developed an entirely bizarre fantasy woman in my head who I was in love with, who was some sort of German banking commuter.
So it's lack of exposure rather than an old knob on young shoulders situation.
Totally. It would have been an amalgam creation from various romantic comedies and things I'd seen on TV, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay.
But
were there female teachers in your school?
Yes. I was brutally in love with my math teacher. Brutally. The level of unlikeliness to the fantasy I had, which is I just thought that one day after a class, she would simply ask me to stay behind as everyone else left and just tell me that she loved me and you know, we'd start kissing and stuff. I genuinely wanted it to happen so much. That I would be quite slow at putting my stuff back into my pencil case at the end of the lesson. I would quite... I mean, I'm not going
to
lie.
You have to give her the opportunity.
Yeah, I would be really... I would like, oh, in goes this pencil. Oh, I guess that pen will have to go in at some point. Here he goes.
And it didn't occur to you at the time that she might be in a relationship and it might be with someone who didn't even own a pencil case at all.
Oh, yeah, almost. It never occurred to me that was almost certainly the case.
What about you, Mike? What were your walls adorned with? Can I imagine what you've got on your walls before you say?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going for a big poster of an F-15 fighter jet.
Okay.
Yeah. Can I guess something? I think one of those Andy Warhol prints where it's like six faces, but it's of Enoch Powell. It's something you had to order it specially.
from Andy Warhol himself?
From Andy Warhol himself. He did it as a private commission.
Yeah, my parents had to remortgage the house for that one. But yeah,
no, I don't know why. Yeah. We're absolutely no reason at all to be painting you as some sort of racist. Such, I don't know why we're doing this.
A tattered Union Jack from the Boer War.
Right, yeah, very good.
Yeah. Come on, this is uncanny, lads.
Yeah.
Maybe a sort of Guitar Hero.
Ah.
On the wall.
A Guitar Hero.
I know you're a Clapton guy.
Yeah, you're on it now.
Yeah, I can see a kind of silhouette of Clapton.
It's all that kind of stuff.
Sort of back arched in that kind of ecstatic guitaring way that really, really turns on very, very middle of the road people. Isn't it? That sense that the man and the guitar have become one.
Yeah, we love all that stuff.
That really gets your dull bastards going.
Oh, man. Yeah. Us middle of the road provincial dullards.
If there's anything you enjoy more than pouring diesel into your lawnmower.
Oh, yeah. And then put on, go back into the house at the end of the day, back in the bungalow, put on a bit of Gary Moore's Parisian Walkways and do a bit of arched back air guitar.
I didn't even know what that is.
It's the ultimate of what you're talking about, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was heavily guitar-based, I would say.
Absolutely. Oh, the other thing I can imagine is framed, a handkerchief, which you think the sort of 30% chance was one of Santana's headdress sort of things. So you found it in Paris, and you knew there was a Santana gig that night, and you thought
Santana would have been absolutely bang on.
Was it you, Henry, who saw a Santana tribute band but thought it was Santana?
I to this day I couldn't tell you for sure whether or not it was actually Santana or a Santana tribute band. I did a gig somewhere in some town not far from London. I can't remember where it was now. Some sort of market town with a corn exchange sort of gig.
The kind of place where Santana regularly walks up.
Well, that's the thing. And I was in a small room. I did my show. And then I was talking to one of the tech people, and he was like, oh, it's quite exciting. Santana's here tonight. Santana's performing in the main room. And I was like, oh, brilliant. I might go and check out Santana. So I went. And the room that Santana was in wasn't huge. It wasn't as big as I was. I sort of imagine Santana playing a stadium sized sort of room.
Well, yeah, he can fill a space. Can't he?
Exactly.
These bums on seats. So
I would say it's like a 200 seater. Right.
It's safe. It's a very safe booking. Safe for Santana.
It's a 200 seater. Everyone, I just gradually know. I thought, you know, Santana, he's one of those sort of slightly world music stars who, where there's about 70 people on stage. during a Santana gig.
A lot of pipes.
Lots of pipes.
Little drums.
Various drum kits, multiple drum kits, lots of backing singers.
Four generations of a single family in the percussion section.
At least. Exactly. It's that world music vibe. So for a start, it takes quite a long time to locate Santana anyway. But eventually, that's Santana. He was sort of moving up and down the stage. He had the shades and the headdress. I thought, yeah, that checks out. That seems to be Santana. But then I noticed how old the audience were. Ancient, everyone was 70s or more. Like most of the audience, a lot of the audience were in my mind. I'm thinking on drips. It probably wasn't. I think there may have been. There was like one person.
Was it just one massive drip on the ceiling? A series of tubes passing into them.
Everyone was very, very old, hunched, crooked. Lots of carers, wheelchairs. Okay, fine. But it's just an old. And then I looked at the stage and I thought, Santana, this is quite weird. Santana's playing this 200-seater pensioners.
It's where he workshops his stuff, his new stuff.
Maybe so. Maybe he was preparing for a bigger gig. But I realised that you look at Santana himself, it's very hard to tell if Santana is essentially in disguise as his look, because he's got shades and the headdress on.
It's a bit like...
Not headdress, he's got this sort of hanky on his head.
Slash from Guns N' Roses. I always feel like Slash may have franchised himself out in the past and basically now just sits at home.
Saddam Hussein did the same thing. It's a good move. If you think you're going to become a big rock star or a major dictator, get a shades and some facial hair into your look early doors or a hanky on your head, something like that. And eventually you can retire and simply franchise it out. You know, you're earning money for free. And anyway,
you could be playing corn exchanges in small towns in England while you're sitting at home in Mexico,
five at the same time.
But anyway, so then I was like, maybe this must be a Santana tribute band. And I think I googled it, but it said like Santana and the Somethings playing. I don't know, I just, to this day, I'm not entirely sure whether it was Santana or not. I think it probably wasn't, but no one there seemed to know. I mean, the audience were none the wiser. So they had a perfectly nice time thinking it was Santana. What do you think? Do you think that was Santana or not?
100% it wasn't Santana.
Oh, was it definitely not Santana?
No, he was playing a 300,000-seater Colosseum in Greece.
Okay.
I think it was, and you've stumbled across the greatest live music conspiracy of all time, and no one will ever give you a straight answer.
But also
answer
the other thing, I think in a more broad way, doesn't it make us ask the question, who is Santana? Because if a load of people, if 200 pensioners watch a Santana gig and go home telling their grandchildren that they saw a Santana gig, does it matter? I mean, maybe it was a Santana gig. I mean, the other option is that Santana himself, like a sort of king that likes to one day a year go amongst his people in disguise, maybe once a year he likes to actually take part in a Santana tribute act.
He flies across the entire Atlantic Ocean and likes to be among... not his people, but some very old people in Aylesbury.
Yeah, in disguise as himself. Now, if that doesn't make you think, I give up. Ben, what posters did you have on your walls?
The two that I can remember, are pretty embarrassing in the way that all teenage posters are. I had, for some reason, a huge poster of Paul Whitehouse from The Fast Show.
Did you really?
That's weird. As himself, like actor headshot or in character?
He was in character as the guy who used to go, brilliant! Do you remember that? I can't really remember how the sketch went, but the guy who sort of said everything was brilliant. It was a big picture of him dressed as him doing thumbs up, and it had the word brilliant underneath.
That's firmly lame. I mean, that's just definitely that is lame, isn't it, that poster?
Yeah, I mean, that's lamer than Batman, I would say.
That is even lamer than Batman.
You have a poster of Paul Whitehouse. We love the Fast Show.
I love
Deutsche Bank.
Comedy.
We love it.
Oh.
The other one I remember is I was heavily into Liv Tyler in the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, really? You had elf fantasies. She was some sort of queen elf, wasn't she?
And she talked in an incredibly sort of voluptuous, slow way.
Oh, she was as old as the hills.
Yeah. But as young as...
But she had a complexion of someone in their mid to late 20s, even though she's 4,000 years old.
Yeah.
That was the unrealistic beauty standard that I was holding all women to.
She wouldn't move a lot. She'd just be very sagacious.
Yeah, she had a noble stillness to her.
That's what I was into, yeah.
She was of the forests.
And pointy ears.
So you had that, interesting. It's an interesting combination.
And I think I got it for free. I think when I went to see one of the Lord of the Rings films, I think the second one, I think they were just giving them out in the cinema, so I got one of those.
You couldn't believe your bloody luck.
It feels like you had a pretty lacklustre attitude to your own posters there. You were just like, yeah, you just got given one. You're like, I'll stick this up, yeah. Whatever.
But no, it was luck. It was, I happened to be given the perfect poster for my burgeoning sexuality.
And so did you use the White House to sort of temper that? Was it a yin-yang thing?
Yeah, were they next to each other or opposite ends of the room?
They were on walls that were next to each other in a corner.
Okay.
So they were sort of looking at each other in a way, gazing at each other.
Two different universes, isn't it? The universe of Tolkien and the universe of The Fast Show, sort of. The two different fictive universes. So what we're seeing, like, posters are this kind of phase you go through, aren't they? Before, like, between childhood and adulthood, there's posters. And then you could sort of do, I'm just thinking, you could sort of do, couldn't you, a sort of Toy Story version of posters where you've got these posters. So when you leave the room, in your case, Ben, Liv Tyler and
Paul Whitehouse of The Fast Show
come to life and
start kissing.
It's literally just the two of them every time. No one else to mix it up.
No one else to mix it up. It's just they chat and they, I mean, presumably just repeatedly realise they have nothing, very, very little in common. So Mike, in your case, all these posters would have come to life.
It'd be a sweet jam.
Yeah, it'd be lovely, like Hendrix jamming with Clapton.
Oh, yeah. It'd be busy. It would sound busy,
I
think.
It'd be like the absolute ultimate mega jam, right, guys? Yeah?
Cool.
Now let's get a Barbie on, and I'm going to talk to you about different kinds of diesel I've been using for my lawnmower.
Oh, keep talking. Oh, this is it. This is the business, Henry.
By the way, have you got fibre optic yet? Because it's absolutely brilliant. Let's just get this mega jam going, and let's discuss fibre optic broadband. Sorry. What am I talking about? Oh, yeah. And then, and in my case, it'd be Batman.
You'd have had Batman and Batman.
Mike Biggs would be loads of Batmans, you know, maybe chatting about teaming up and becoming the Batmen. I don't know. And then what happens is you become a proper adult and you take your posters down, like in the end of Toy Story.
Yes.
And you roll them up and you discard them. And it's quite touching. And what happens is at the end, you know, you've thrown away, Liv Tyler's gone through the shredder. Horrible scene. Really, really hard to watch.
Yeah. Paul Whitehouse's character is still saying, brilliant, because that's all he can say, but he's saying it in an ever more sad way.
Yeah. In the script, his last line is brilliant, but this time it's got a question mark at the end.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Oh, my God.
And so you think he's going to die. You're going to stick him in the recycling. But actually, you save him. And it's like, oh, you've kept one. And you take it to your new home, and he's like, brilliant. And then the last scene is him being sort of trapped under glass because you're framing him. And he's like, oh, no. Ah. And he's kind of squished up in the glass because you frame him. That's what you do, isn't it? You frame some of them as you get older.
Well, I think the thing is, when you get older then, I think the kind of the framed print scene, which is basically the world we're in now, right? as adults is the same as teenage posters in terms of its intent.
Which is signalling...
It's still about sort of demonstrating your... Yeah,
taste.
Exactly.
But it has to be a bit more carefully considered at this point, right?
Yeah, you've got to curate this stuff properly.
The big one that I feel like I see a lot, but I don't feel I could ever pull off personally, is the framed print of a poster of a Tate Modern exhibition that happened in the 90s.
Yes. Oh. Walter Sickert, 23rd of August to the 11th of November.
Yeah.
Tate Modern,
Who do you think you are?
I sometimes want to get something on holiday because it feels like this would be like authentic to me, and you know, because I went to this place, so I can bring back something. But then you go to the shops and they're just full of absolute tat. And it's like, am I going to get another? You know, no offense, Mike. A lot of this stuff is produced in the West Country. Another absolute dog shit. Like, literally, the artist made no effort. Picture of a little boat on the sea. Like, no effort, no love's gone into it. Just lovelessly churned out. Absolute crap, this stuff, isn't it? Piles of it being sold in shops in the West Country.
You've got to be careful because, you know, I mean, some offence taken. Some of those West Country artists will spend a full morning trying to find a half-rotten piece of driftwood, you know, to nail a shell to.
Before they decorate it. It's a lot of time, exactly. It takes a lot of time to find the right piece of driftwood, to find the right shells to glue to it, you know. And then put that on a plinth and then someone can put that on their wall.
Yes, yeah. The maritime tat industry, I dread to think how much money it's worth, but I imagine it's billions. It will be in the billions per annum.
And a large portion of that market is the nautically themed bathroom scene, which for some reason is popular. Mm. There's nothing inherently nautical about a bathroom, but you'll often see a shell in there. Someone's put a little shell.
My parents have shells in their bathroom. It's almost impossible to resist the urge to give a very slight maritime twist to a bathroom. It's very hard for it's almost impossible for a human being not to make a small nod to the world of seafaring.
But why? Well, it's the freshness, isn't it? The freshness, you give the sense of the freshness of the sea air. I think that's what
it is.
Are
you also sort of prefiguring where your feces is going to end up?
It's a little a tribute
you are.
To the ultimate
it's
recipient.
It's like a sort of travel agency
of your
for your turd, isn't it? You go into a little office room where there's like objects and pictures representing. It's almost like you're just trying to gently get them into the idea of it because they're about to go through, you know, your turd is about to go through something very traumatic. It's been shot out of an anus, drowned, and then transported through miles upon miles of wet tunnels into a vast endless ocean. It's very traumatic. So I think,
Or it's like a sniffer dog and you're giving it the scent. You're giving it the, this is where you're going to end up, buddy.
Yeah.
This is a one-way street. You go there, you don't come
exactly.
back.
And either way, it would be wrong to expect it to go there with no warning and no preparation. You're right.
The very first thought that came into my mind was of a friend I had as a kid who lived quite near me, who his mother was understandably and not unreasonably concerned about his access to pornographic material as a teenage boy. He knew that if he was ever caught with a dirty rag and under his bedclothes or what have you, he'd be in a heap of trouble. But what was allowed was he was allowed to cut out the underwear adverts from his mother's fashion magazines. So his walls were absolutely covered from top to toe in cutouts of ladies in bras and gift-worthy underwear.
So it feels to me that he was following the very much the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law, wasn't it?
He found a loophole, and she
couldn't do anything about it because, he'd heard what she had to say. He'd looked at the fine print, essentially.
You know, we've all been in rooms where there's a lot of posters, but, I mean, this was the covering was intense. It was intense. I don't remember the way I remembered it. There was not an inch of wall spare.
Quite the opposite to that. I once met someone where his mum had every day bought the Sun and had cut out the photograph of the topless woman from page 3 and put it in a ring binder, which was his, and because she sort of felt it was healthy for a young man. Pretty weird.
Wow.
But for me, it's the introduction of the ring binder that I find interesting. It's almost like thinking if we can combine this objectification of the female form with stationery, with healthy stationery.
Can we fetishize stationery?
Can we move it onto a fetishization of hole punchers? Yeah. If we can transfer him onto hole punchers, it's then easier to treat.
By the time he's 21, hopefully he'll be fucking a laminator.
That putting them in the ring binder, that's an extraordinary idea. And I suppose you could then bring in dividers, couldn't you? And you could then start categorizing them. I tell you one thing that ring binder would have blown out of the water was the fallacy that the Sun tried to make the nation believe, which was that these were all different women that had different hobbies and interests.
Right.
Whereas the truth is, if you followed it for about a year, there was a rotation.
Oh, really? He would easily be able to audit the alleged pastimes of the models.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd be able to go, you're Samantha, who's allegedly interested in greyhound racing, or are you Bernice, who's interested in long walks?
Yeah.
He could have blown the whole thing wide open.
Hang on, literally one in three of these models is taking saxophone lessons. This can't be right.
Do you remember Page Seven Fella?
No, what's that?
No.
It's such an 80s idea. I think it was 80s. They tried to, the Sun thought, well, you know what? People are complaining about these lovely ladies we got on page three. Tell you what, we'll even up the playing field a bit. And they had introduced a thing called Page Seven Fella.
Oh, yeah.
Which was basically a bloke, just sort of like a muscly bloke.
Yeah. Holding a couple of tyres.
Just holding a couple of tyres or like a big drill or something. It was just like, just some more sort of 80s gender stereotyping. But
a model, again, not like Smash Hits or Just 17's Torso of the Week or whichever one it was. I can't remember.
Oh, it might have been something similar. But
because that would be a celeb. I remember Tony Blair being Torso of the Week.
Is this when he was Prime Minister?
This is at his peak. Yeah, he was snapped on a, it was kind of one of those Prime Ministerial holiday snaps. Yeah, but he popped out on a balcony, lauding it, naked from the waist up. Not unreasonably on your holiday, but he'd been snapped and someone said, hello, our Tony's a bit tasty.
The bar for being good looking in the world of politics is so low. It's very low, the bar for being good. Because like Tony Blair, I do remember now, was sort of considered vaguely hot in some way,
I
wasn't
think
he?
So, yeah.
The person who wasn't considered at all hot, despite being a similar age as Blair was when he was Prime Minister, was David Cameron, who you never heard anyone... And he's a normal-looking guy, but he there's something uniquely unsexy about David Cameron.
He looks like an androgynous sort of cartoon character or something, doesn't he? He's got very big round eyes, very big white round eyes, and sort of like a little...
First draft cartoon character.
Yeah, he's like a very...
He's too smooth.
He actually looks a bit like very early Mickey Mouse. You know those like 1920s right. black and white cartoons with the big round eyes and big, like a foot that's always tapping because they're always like jiggling. He's got that sort of
Steamboat
face.
Willie era.
Cameron. Yeah, exactly. It's totally Steamboat Willie. Just always like smile on his face, tapping his foot. Everything's going to be fine. Very, very smooth face though. Like a cartoon face where you haven't drawn any stubble on.
Yes. I saw a photo of him last week because he had the vaccine. And there was a photo of him getting it put in his arm. And he has got really buff since leaving the highest office in the land. He's got these huge arms, like sort of Popeye
That's
style.
Gross. Why? That's disgusting.
Yeah. Because these days, it doesn't seem that odd. But if John Major had done that in 1997,
if he'd got ripped.
Yeah, that would have been so weird.
If John Major had buffed up.
I'd love to have seen a shredded John Major at the Chilcot Inquiry. Just slipping his shirt up a little bit to show us his sweet abs.
John Major, the idea of John Major with like panning down to see him having this incredibly sexy, muscly bod under that face. What that reminds me of is, do you watch He-Man, the cartoon, Skeletor?
Yeah.
It was the same kind of cognitive dissonance. Because like, Skeletor had the face of a skull. But an incredibly muscly hot bod, fleshy muscles. And it just didn't, they too jarred, didn't make sense. But same, imagine John Major with that muscly bod.
You don't get posters of prime ministers, do you, on the whole?
Well, didn't David Cameron famously have a poster of Margaret Thatcher in his bedroom when he was at university?
Did he really?
I'm sure I read that.
I mean, how has he got his hands on that is my question, because I've never seen that. You can get pop stars and popes, no problem.
I have, in my life, I have flipped through literally, I would say, hundreds of miles of those heavy laminated poster books that you used to flip through. And I've never, I don't think
the Athena Perusa.
Yeah, the Athena Perusa. I've come across both of the Belushi brothers. I've come across stormtroopers and popes, as Mike said. I've come across Marilyn with the dress up. I've come across Roger Rabbit. Never Maggie. Where the hell did you get that? That's a really good question. Is that an Eton thing?
You don't even generally see them that much in, even when they're doing sort of political advertising. Certainly in this country. I mean, if you're in a country with a despot, absolutely, the image will be everywhere. Posters and billboards, mega posters.
Yes, and I guess our beloved despots, the royal family, they sort of realise they can't get away with that level of idolatry. You know, as compared to your Mao's, for example, they try to keep it on the down low.
They do, and they tend to appear on ceramics rather than posters and
that's right.
billboards and the like. They prefer, it's a more discreet...
It's optional ceramics.
Yeah.
Well, it's stamps and money, isn't it? That's it. That's all we have.
Yeah, maybe that's enough.
For the royals, is stamps and money.
Well, the royals famously don't carry money, which I've never understood, really.
Just toilets.
Do they carry toilets?
Well, that's another royal rumour, isn't it? That the Queen, notoriously, wherever she goes, there's a regal loo in the boot of the car.
Well, Prince Charles has got a sort of shiny white leather toilet seat that he takes with him wherever he goes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And the Queen has similar rumours, yeah.
And he lays it down on top of the...
I think they unscrew whatever toilet seat's already there and then screw on his white patent leather
one. They're all footmen. The royal arseman steps in with a screwdriver.
So he must have an excellent toolkit, that guy. Because you get a...
He can fit it to any toilet.
There's a wide range of different toilet sizes and shapes. So he's got a kind of universal adapter kit, has he?
Yeah, he'll have a full case of Allen keys and he won't have lost any of them and he'll know exactly where they are as well.
But how do you...
That's what sets him apart from a general member of the public.
I'm thinking it must have some sort of hard rubberized lip.
The toilet servant. No. Explain.
This toilet... seat, which allegedly he can fit onto any other toilet. It must have, I'm trying to think, in terms of the actual, how you get the things to attach, it's got to have something like a hard rubberized lip, which can adhere, sort of suck onto things of different sizes.
What about a series of tiny little suckers? Like a sort of, like a tentacle?
Yeah,
Would that work on any surface?
Using octopus technology? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think something like that. It's got to involve creating a vacuum to create suction, isn't it? Because... otherwise, what you're drilling into the previous toilet seat to, if you're attaching screws and things, then you're damaging the previous toilet seat.
It is possible to replace a toilet seat, Henry. You don't just get one for your whole life.
You don't just move house.
That's what I do. when the royals sweep into town,
I imagine they go ahead. This footman goes ahead, and lays the ground
incognito.
So if they're like the prince is likely to go to a Starbucks or whatever. They'll go into that Starbucks toilet, take the seat off.
Yeah, he'll have to buy a coffee himself because he'll need the code on the receipt, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he'll get the job done.
And then he'll fit the toilet seat on and then he'll do that thing where people kind of stick to the ceiling by holding on to the walls with his arms and legs and just stay there.
In case he's needed.
So if anyone else comes in and before the prince, he can just, with a silenced pistol, shoot them.
You open the door to that toilet and you see the leatherette toilet seat and the penny starts to drop. You look up, you see the man stuck to the ceiling.
In his full royal livery.
Yeah, and you just have in that fraction of a second, you work out exactly what's happened. You're like, I remember seeing that the royals are visiting town today. Someone mentioned that at work. Oh, the leatherette toilet seat, that'll be Prince Charles's special toilet seat that I've heard. You look up, you see the shadow of a man attached to the ceiling with suckers, and you're like, of course, I cannot have seen the royal toilet seat and live. Of course not. And you bow your head willingly, and he shoots your brain off. And you die happy.
And I assume the bodies just stay there then until Charles arrives?
There was a rumour in the late 80s when he was at his most arrogant, he would say he would refuse to use a toilet unless he could climb a staircase of corpses to get to it.
So there we go. That was posters. Truly rinsed as a topic, I think.
It was the definitive discussion, and thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening. If you have any ideas for future topics you'd like us to cover, do send us an email at 3beansaladpod@gmail.com, or you can contact us at our Twitter account, which is at beansaladpod.
And the Gmail, the three bean, the three, it's the word three, not the number three. It's as unwieldy as it could possibly be. So if you do manage to punch through all that and contact us, we'll be absolutely thrilled.
3beansaladpod@gmail.com or Twitter, beansaladpod.
And remember, double check that spelling, because when an email address involves two or more words that are conflated together into what without the spaces into one jumbo word, can be quite sickening to look at, quite sickening to do, but take the time to recheck that word, recheck that spelling.
Also, you know, get in contact if you have just anything to say about the topic of posters, anything we've said. Were you disgusted by it? Were you enlightened by it? Were you deeply moved?
Yeah, and if you've got any of your own thoughts about posters, please share those with us and we might read them out on the next one.
But only if they're interesting.
But only if they're interesting and good. Good thoughts, really. Please don't make them too long.
Well, like this outro.
I think any email that's like long is from someone mad. It has to be. Do you ever get an email and you go, look at the length of that. Jesus fucking Christ, this person has fucking lost it before you've even started reading it.
But often it'll just be from a building society or something, won't it? That kind of length of email?
Yeah. Or
HMRC.
Or HMRC. And if HMRC or a building society was a person, they would be fucking mad.
Satire as well. That's the thing with the show.
Just be careful, Henry. You're gonna ruffle some very dangerous feathers with that kind of talk. Yeah.
Sorry.
That kind of fresh, unrestrained talk.
You probably will never be able to go to Cheltenham nor Gloucester ever again.
People say, oh, don't ruffle any feathers as if it's a big deal. But since when has anything scary got feathers? I'll ruffle them all I fucking like. They only belong to a fucking bird.
What, like an eagle owl? Rip your bloody head off, mate.
One of the few exceptions. That would be a mistake to ruffle your feathers.
What's that bird that's like an emu, but it's got like a sort of dinosaur-style claw that it can like rip your face off with? Is it a rhea?
Well, yeah, it's got a special beak that can remove your liver in one single movement.
Is that rhea as in Chris Rhea?
Yeah. That's his ancestors back in the day, we can assume, would have been land-based,
so is the song,
very fast-moving birds.
Oh, no, I've got mixed up with someone else. I was going to say, is the song Free Falling about a bird that's injured itself in flight? But that's not by Chris Rea, is it?
No.
But it is. You're right. They're on both anyway, yeah.
But
by another happy coincidence.
Yeah. But also, Rheas are flightless, so I guess they would free fall if you knocked it off a cliff or out of a plane or something.
And I suppose if you were driving home for Christmas as a rhea, that would suggest that you've had an injury. If you're not choosing to fly.
They don't fly. They can't fly.
Well, hence driving home for Christmas makes full sense.
Well, they would probably sprint home for Christmas, I imagine, across the savannah.
I've never heard of a rhea.
It's very much, it's the lesser talked about, of the ostrich emu gang. It's very much comes in bronze.
I think it's the kind of bird where if it gets out, you know, in a zoo, they've got like there's a certain animals, if they get out, you have to call the army. I think it's one of those.
Which branch of the army, are we talking sort of heavy artillery, are we talking, or sort of light infantry?
I think it's tanks.
It's straight
I'm looking
science.
At okay. An aggressive looking rhea. They look fucking terrifying because you can't reason with them at all like you can with a bear or even a crocodile compared to a rhea. Yeah, a bear you can't reason with them,
you can't zigzag them. You can try climbing up a tree, I suppose. Can't.
Henry, are you reviewing your policy then that there's nothing scary that you can ruffle feathers wise?
Well, yeah, okay, there's some exceptions. I still think broadly, if you're ruffling feathers, the worst that's going to happen to you is you're going to get a little peck off something quite cute.
You're going to get eviscerated by a gigantic sprinting beast.
In the case of a rhea, I would not want to ruffle the feathers of a rhea. Jesus. But the thing with a rhea is, and all of the tall, flightless birds with sort of weirdly human, slightly sexy looking legs. So we're talking the rhea, the emu, and the ostrich.
You don't mind a flamingo either, do you?
A bit skinny for me.
Backwards knees.
And the backwards knees thing is not a fan of. You just wouldn't know what would ruffle their feathers. That's the thing that frightens me with them, because they're so inhuman birds.
They're so unknowable.
So unknowable, but not in an enticing, sexy way. You know, like, I don't know.
Nigella Lawson.
Like Nigella Lawson, exactly. but in a kind of that tiny little peanut sized brain is just full of primal hate. That I can't understand, and nothing I can say is going to calm that rear down. Whereas a bear is mammalian, you know, at least you know that essentially understands things like the idea of a hug or a nice getting your feet up or chilling up.
Of the family unit.
It's got a family unit. Whereas a rhea, what the fuck is that thing doing with that neck and those weird sexy human legs?
Yeah. You proffer a jar of honey at a rhea, it's just going to pick it up, smash it to pieces and use the shards to dice you into a thousand tiny pieces.
Yeah.
And they've got kind of sexy eyelashes as well. They're sort of, they've got the very stereotypical, like, 1950s classic sexy woman.
Got eyelashes to die for. We'd all love those eyelashes. But
they have the fluttering eyelashes, don't they, of a sort of golden age of Hollywood.
Sort of 50s movie star. Yeah.
But they're coming at you and they're pecking you and there's blood on your hands and they're just pecking and pecking and pecking and the eyes are looking flirty and the legs are... They're just so smooth and so sort of well-toned.
The talons are gripped into your bonnet and its head has punched its way straight through your front windshield in a perfect hole.
And it's just...
And through your neck and out the other side. And your wife's screaming.
Yeah. And you're still part of you just wants to sort of clutch that leg, because it's that leg that's now sort of wrapped itself around your neck and is starting to gradually crush your spine. Feathers flying everywhere.
And all you can do is just wait. All you can do is wait for the tank's first salvo of shells to just obliterate
and
all of you.
You're trying to punch it. You're trying to grab it. But all you're doing is sort of harmlessly plucking feathers out of it, which are then filling up the car.
You're continuing to ruffle the feathers even further.
You're actually ruffling and making it worse.
Yeah, so it's like that, or whatever it was.
Yeah, I can't remember how we got onto rears, but if you have any thoughts, if you've ever seen or been attacked by a rear, please get in contact at beansaladpod or... 3beansaladpod@gmail.com.
Or actually, if you've ever met or seen in real life Chris Rea.
Oh, God, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And certainly, particularly, if you have been alerted to the fact that a Rea is on the loose, please get in touch urgently and let us know where.
Have you been attacked by Chris Rea?
Yeah. Chris Rea has an anecdote he tells about the making of the song Coming Home for Christmas, Driving Home for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And in the anecdote, he actually was driving home for Christmas.
No way.
This anecdote is dangerously boring at this stage, Henry, so...
He actually was...
Tell you what, Henry, shall we take this bit off?
No, but he actually was...
Was the greatest
he was driving home for Christmas,
shall we bid farewell to our listeners?
No, but here's the thing.
Henry?
He was driving home for Christmas. And then when he got home, he told his wife about the idea he'd had where he was driving home for Christmas, and then it becomes this kind of infinite loop. And then he got home and told his wife about the song where he was driving home for Christmas, and then he got home, told his wife. Do you see what I mean?
And now you're trapped in that loop as well.
We're all trapped in that. All the listeners are trapped in that loop.
It's frightening, though.
I don't understand the anecdote.
No, it's quite hard to follow.
But never, do you mean my anecdote or Chris Rea's anecdote?
I think it's Chris Rea's anecdote.
Two sides of the same coin.
Through the prism of your telling of it, made it incredibly hard to work out what was going on.
Well, it's a kaleidoscope, isn't it? And it's enticing and dangerous at the same time.
Like a rhea.
Like
like a rhea. Oh, God.
Is it true that rear view mirrors were initially...
No.
The reason they're called that is they were designed for people driving around Longleat Safari Park. Because we're dangerous of being attacked.
Stop. Stop him. Ben, do something.
Right, so that was the first episode.
Thanks a lot.
And do send us some ideas for a future conversation. Have we done that?
Yeah, that's always an important bit. Yeah, I mean, here you've already heard posters and basically a sort of section about Rias as well.
Yeah.
So anything like that.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Ta-da!